got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken vein.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English, Special Projects Editor at the Genetic Literacy Project. Today, we're talking with Dr. Allison Van Edenum, who is a geneticist at the University of California, Davis. And Dr. Van Edenum works with animal gene editing, which is an important technology that can be used to make agricultural animals resistant to really deadly diseases, and it can also spare them painful procedures like castration or horn removal. And so the technology is very promising. The problem is the FDA has come out and said it's going to regulate gene-edited animals as if they were pharmaceutical drugs. And so this is going to add many years to the development process and many millions of dollars to the point that the technology really can't be implemented. And so Dr. Van Edenum has been a really vocal critic of the FDA in this regard, and she's trying to get them to reverse course. And so we're going to talk about this issue and see, what does animal gene editing look like in the next few years, and can anything be done to change it? So I hope you stick around. Thank you for listening. The one issue I did want to mention is that the FDA came out after we recorded this podcast and said that genetically engineered salmon can actually be imported into the U.S. now. So since 2016, that wasn't allowed, and we didn't cover it in the interview because it didn't happen yet. So I want you to be aware of that. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening. If you like the podcast, check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. And then coming soon, you can also subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Podcasts if you like the show. Thank you very much. Dr. Allison Van Edenum, thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So, just to get started, can you explain what gene editing is and why agricultural scientists like yourself are so interested in it before we get into the more controversial part of the issue?
So gene editing is, to my way of thinking, a way to introduce useful genetic variation into breeding programs. And it utilizes these site-directed nucleases like CRISPR is kind of the fancy one at the moment, to go in and make a targeted break at a very precise location in the genome. And so breeders can use it to do things like inactivate a gene that maybe results in something that you don't want in your breeding program. For example, pig breeders have gone in and turned off a gene that makes pigs susceptible to a disease called PRRS. And so they're basically just disease-resistant pigs in that particular example. Or you might go in and maybe do an edit that gives another useful attribute to the animals that you'd like to use in your breeding program, which is kind of what animal breeders and plant breeders do now, but we rely on the variation that's introduced by nature, also known as, you know, mutations that are basically the basis of evolution and all of our animal and plant selection programs as well.
So in your opinion, why does this matter to the average consumer at the grocery store? So it sounds like this is going to be a big deal for animal welfare and of course, for breeders and scientists like yourself. But why do I care? Someone at the grocery store shopping for my family, why does this matter to me?
Well, you may not appreciate it, but actually breeding is a pretty important component of agricultural sustainability. And so if you look historically at conventional breeding programs, and here I'm talking about just using selection of the best parents to be the parents of the next generation, that's had the impact of really reducing the overall environmental impact of maybe a loaf of bread or a glass of milk. So a glass of milk today has about one third of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with a glass of milk in the 1950s. And a lot of that is due to improvements in genetics. And so there's this kind of knock-on benefit to the environment that's a hidden benefit that maybe most people aren't aware of. But we also can target things like disease resistance. So a lot of people are concerned about antibiotic use and animal welfare. And if we had animals that don't get sick, obviously that's good for the animal. It's good for the farmer. And ultimately, it's good because we can use less antibiotics. So there are benefits to using genetics to solve problems in agriculture rather than chemicals. And I think a lot of people would think that's a good use of the technology.
Yeah, and just curiously, I thought of this just as we were speaking, but the same groups that oppose gene editing, and they call it, you know, GMO 2.0. These are the same people that are concerned about antibiotic use in agriculture. And so I'm not sure what to make of that, because you're presenting a very viable solution, at least, you know, technically speaking, and they're opposed to that. So I don't know what to make of that. What do you think of that while we're on the subject?
I mean, I think there's some really interesting, I call them sustainability goal conflicts. So, you know, sustainability is this kind of three-legged stool. So there's the environment, there's economics, both food prices and farmer prices, and then the kind of the social leg of the stool, if you want. And quite often you have an interplay and a tension between those three stool legs. And so maybe you're particularly concerned, for example, about animal welfare, but you oppose genetic engineering because of theoretically environmental issues. And then you get presented with something like dehorning cattle, where you could actually use genetics to address an animal welfare concern. And it creates this kind of conflict between those two legs of sustainability. And depending where you put your relative emphasis, I think different people will come to different determinations as to how important that goal is to them and whether it, quote unquote, overrides their concern around the other aspect of sustainability, or where they're, as with most technologies in life, they're willing to accept the risks and benefits and ultimately go with the technology that in their rubric offers the most benefits.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm curious to see how that resolves itself in the next, say, 4 or 5 years, but we'll just leave it there for now. So the main reason I wanted to chat with you is because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has come up with a really, let's say, interesting way to regulate gene-edited animals. And I guess from what I read in the Science Journal Nature just last week, I believe, end of February, there's researchers in your field that are actually packing up their labs here in the United States and moving to countries like Brazil, where the regulatory burden is a lot lighter, where you can actually do your research and you have, you know, hopes of commercializing it. So tell me a little bit about that situation.
Yeah, it's kind of a long history behind it, but basically under the coordinated framework, the FDA is exercising regulatory authority over genetically altered animals using the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and basically are classifying all alterations as being new animal drugs. And technically, a drug is defined as something that alters the form or function of an animal and humans. And I mean, I would argue, yeah, sure, DNA does alter the form and function of ourselves. That's why I look like, and you look like what you look like. But we haven't historically considered it to be a drug. And so this was first introduced when they were regulating genetically engineered organisms, where you were actually introducing maybe a gene from a different species, and that species was hadn't maybe been in the food supply before. And so there was concerns potentially around allergens or toxins that had to be looked at. And that made some sense, I guess, although I guess it was an awkward fit into a regulatory approach that really wasn't fit for purpose as it relates to genetics. But when you're talking about editing, where potentially in the case of the pigs, you've inactivated a gene, you've knocked out a little sequence of DNA, the absence of that DNA nucleotides then becomes a drug. And it becomes a little hard to kind of start implementing that in terms of the absence of a sequence is a drug, because if you look at the genetic variation between individuals of the same species, you and I, for example, will have many, many differences in terms of our DNA sequence, and I'll have some DNA missing that doesn't actually have any impact on me, but it'll be different to your DNA. And if we're going to regulate those naturally occurring variations as drugs, then it becomes, well, what isn't a drug then? Is our entire genome a drug? And, you know, why would we regulate only those that are associated with gene editing differently to the variation that we see as a result of spontaneous mutations and variation?
Well, if you don't know the answer to that, then I'm not sure who does, because so, all right, not to be too cynical or sarcastic or anything, but the FDA must have a geneticist or two on staff that's familiar with the literature on the subject. And so what I'm wondering is, are they paying attention to what people like you are saying? Are they looking at the research, or, I mean, where is this coming from? I know they're probably afraid of an allergen perhaps, or, you know, something like that, but where is this all coming from? Cause we'll get into the USDA in a second.
Kind of coming as a result of the regulatory framework they're operating under, right? So they have to operate under the laws that bind them, and the way that they can regulate it is if it's a drug. We don't regulate breeding, conventional breeding. So I mentioned earlier about, you know, a glass of milk today has one third the greenhouse gas associated with a glass of milk in the 50s. A lot of that is due to natural selection for cows that make more milk. And a lot of that is just based on kind of random variation that occurs in the genome of cows, where we've selected for cows that have mutations that result in more milk. And none of that is evaluated from a safety perspective. It's just basically evolution, if you want to think of it that way, or in this case, artificial selection. And so we haven't regulated that. So the only way that you could exercise regulatory authority over, you know, intentional alterations is to put it under a framework that you are legally allowed to operate under, and therefore it came in as a new animal drug, because then there is regulatory authority. But that was set up, the Food, Drug and Cosmetic Act, back way before DNA was discovered. I think it was Roosevelt actually brought it in. And so it was intended for, you know, chemicals like, I don't know, aspirin or dogwormers or drugs that are chemicals you introduce into the body. It's not really intended for naturally occurring variations that exist in DNA of an animal. And so it's just an awkward fit for that regulatory authority.
Yeah, I think it was like 1938, I want to say. It was decades ago.
Well, just to be clear, DNA was discovered by Watson and Crick, what was that, 1953, I think?
Yeah,
was that?
Yeah, that's right. So we're regulating this with a law that's that predates the actual material you're trying to regulate. So, okay, so you had mentioned that the FDA had set up, at least you mentioned this in the paper that I was looking through, that the FDA had this kind of regulatory regime looking at genetically modified organisms, you know, using the popular term. And I think you say that effectively that's kept genetic engineering almost entirely out of animal breeding programs. Is that right? Because there's only one product that we can get into, which is...
So basically, ironically, genetically engineered animals have... The first papers about that came before the plant papers about 30 years ago. And so we've been able to introduce, in this case, DNA from a different species or a relative using genetic engineering for about 30 years. But the only product that's ever gone through as a food animal use has been the AquaAdvantage salmon, the fast-growing salmon. And that basically was developed in, I think it was 1989. It was over a quarter of a century ago. And it had this very long and torturous regulatory review and was finally approved in 2015. But then there was political interference in that decision, and at the current time it's still not allowed to be sold in the United States due to a rider on the budget bill that was introduced by senators from Alaska, who obviously have the wild caught fishing interests to protect. And so basically the cost and time associated with that has really discouraged any other industry or any other commercial player from taking a product through the market. And that's really more or less for my entire career, about 20 years, has kind of disincentivized research funding into genetic engineering, and certainly commercial investment into bringing genetically engineered food animals to market. And that's, I mean, that be that as it may, it has to be associated with the trade-off associated with doing nothing. And so some of the animals that have been produced are disease-resistant animals. The Phytase Enviro pig in Canada that had 75% decreased pollution from phosphorus in its manure. So those problems didn't go away. So cows still get sick and pigs still produce manure with high levels of phosphorus. So we can't use the technology, but that didn't solve the problem either. And that trade-off of kind of doing nothing, I think, is part of the discussion that needs to be looked at, because everything has risks and benefits associated with it. And if you don't do anything, that's also risky. And it has risks and benefits associated with it. And I think that the trade-offs associated with blocking innovation are rarely discussed, but are actually very important. What if we had said no genetic improvement of milk cows back in the 1950s? You know, we would have, I did the math, and we, at the moment, we have around 9 million dairy cows in the US. And if we were had used 1950 production levels and inefficient genetics, we'd need around 40 million. So that 30 million cows that aren't here is kind of the opportunity cost that would have been associated with not enabling breeding improvements in the dairy cattle industry over the last 50 years.
Yeah, it's really, really astounding, I think. And this is a quote from the paper, just to underscore the significance of what we're talking about. So you say, quote, "Regrettably, the FDA approach has not enabled the use of any technology that utilizes recombinant DNA, or GMO, just if anyone's not aware, in food animal breeding programs. No food from an animal that has an intentional genotype produced from any technology that utilizes our DNA has ever reached the U.S. market." So we're talking effectively, even if they don't mean it, it's basically a ban on what you guys are trying to achieve. Is that right?
It's not technically a ban. It's financially impossible, certainly for public sector researchers at universities and small companies to contemplate bringing a product through, let alone taking it to other countries as well. And so it's the entire premise of why people don't like GMOs is because only large multinational corporations can afford to take it through regulatory. And that's exactly what has happened here, except there isn't really the equivalent kind of large multinational animal breeding corporation that there is with plants. And so there just basically has been no animal that's moved through. And so it's a quasi ban. So it's not technically illegal to do this. We're just going to make it so incredibly expensive and timely that you won't actually be able to bring anything through.
Sure. So in effect, and I mean, I'm not accusing anyone of having ill motives or anything. I just mean, if you can't do it, then you can't do it. So, let's contrast this for me with the USDA, because the USDA has oversight of gene edited plants. And Sonny Perdue has been really supportive. And I think he even came out recently and called the anti-GMO activism the Fear Our Food campaign. So they're really pushing this technology. I'm just wondering, is it just the fact that they're operating under different laws? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, there is that to some extent. So the way that the USDA regulates plants is different to the way the FDA regulates animals. And so plants that are being gene edited that don't introduce DNA from a different species. In other words, plants that could have been achieved using conventional breeding but can perhaps be done in a more speedy way using gene editing are not going to be subject to additional regulatory oversight above what's normally applied to food and plants breeding, because plant breeding, again, isn't regulated. And so I can bring a new variety of sunflower to market without any formal regulatory oversight. There's an overriding rule in the US. It's illegal to sell unsafe food, period. And that's really the bottom line. And so basically the way that breeding is handled is the companies check the, new variety of potato doesn't have high levels of solanines or whatever before they bring those products to market. But they do it because they don't want to bring unsafe products to market, not because they're mandated to by the regulatory oversight. And so there's just a fundamental difference in the way that the plants and animals are being proposed to be regulated. And I guess to me, it's all food at the end of the day. And so having a fundamental difference between the two kingdoms, plants and animals, doesn't really make much sense from a scientific perspective.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about researchers who are leaving the country. Obviously, you know some of these people. I mean, are they just so fed up that that they're leaving? Is it really that bad?
Well, I think that, so I do know some of the researchers. So one of the people that was interviewed was Dr. Chuck Long at Texas A&M. And unfortunately, part of the issue is that when you consider all animals that have been intentionally altered to be drugs, it means that those animals can't go into the food supply. And if you're working with large livestock, like Chuck works with cattle, then basically if you do an intentional edit where maybe you, I don't know, knock out a gene to, in his case, I think he was working on myostatin, those animals are no longer able to go into the food supply. And so typically our research herds here at the university where we're doing breeding experiments to select for, I don't know, disease-resistant cattle using conventional breeding, their calves all go into our food supply, and it's kind of it doesn't make them not eligible for the food supply, and that enables our herds to keep running, because obviously if we can't put them in the food supply, then we have no income coming in to kind of keep the place running. And so when we're talking large animals, just considering anything with an edit becomes incredibly expensive from a research perspective, because those animals have to be discarded through incineration, which not only loses their uses of food, but it also costs money to incinerate them. And that's not expensive if you're working with mice, but when you're working with a 1,000-pound bull, as you can imagine, it becomes quite expensive. And so I think that Dr. Long expressed that he's sick of having the types of regulations here, when other countries, and he I think mentioned going to South America, Brazil, if I'm not mistaken, have taken the approach that, similar to the USDA in plants, that if you're not introducing novel DNA sequences and you could have achieved it using conventional breeding, then it's just a cow, and it's a cow like any other. And so I think that's where some of the researchers are expressing concern at the academic level. And then at the company level, there was a couple of companies that had suggested that they were trying to do commercialization in countries that have a more product risk-based regulatory approach rather than the one that's triggered by intentional alterations, which is what we have. And so, for example, Brazil and Argentina, and actually Canada, have a product based approach rather than this kind of arbitrary trigger based on which technology you happen to use to introduce the alteration.
So just as we start to wrap up, I want to ask you just one devil's advocate question, because there have been a few preliminary studies that have been published that seem to indicate that CRISPR, for example, can potentially have some off-target effects. So is there anything to worry about if you're a consumer and you're just not familiar with this technology? Like, should we be worried at all, or is it really, really safe?
Well, I mean, I think you have to put kind of genetic diversity in perspective. And so if I look at two identical bulls from the same breed, they will literally have millions of SNP variations and about a million insertions and deletions that are just have been introduced naturally. In other words, it's just spontaneous mutations, which is actually the very basis of how we've developed our breeds, right? So there's a spontaneous mutation that happened in the wolf that eventually led to a cocker spaniel and a dachshund, right? And so we're not eating our dogs necessarily, but same in our plant and animal food programs. And so if the level of background alterations is not above that which happens spontaneously every generation, then it's just DNA variation at that. It's just food at that stage. And that really, I think, the risk associated with a SNP when we're talking about food is none. We eat genetic variations every day. Every meal we've ever consumed is genetically different to every other meal we've ever consumed, and our body looks at it and says, oh, look, DNA, and breaks it down into, you know, T's and C's and G's and A's, and then rebuilds it into our DNA. That's kind of how digestion works. And so I think that this, the kind of the off target is really, is there a higher level than is in the background? Because that background has to be the basis upon which everything is compared to. And I don't think that we see higher levels compared to the background. And there's certainly the papers that, that say that and show that, in fact, certainly radiation mutagenesis, which is used in plant breeding, which introduces thousands of mutations, goes to the market now without any regulatory oversight. And so we have a history of intentionally altering the genotype of our plants, and that has not been associated with any novel food product risks. So really, to me, let's focus on the actual characteristics of the animal or the plant, its ingredients, in the case of plants, what its, you know, composition is made up of. And this kind of focus on the molecular level of it, I think, is not what we do with our traditional breeding programs. It's not what we do with mutation breeding programs. And so to suddenly require that for plants and animals that could have been achieved using conventional breeding just because you happen to use gene editing doesn't really make much logical sense to me. And, you know, the benefits are so potentially important in terms of developing disease-resistant crops, drought-tolerant crops, crops with improved nutrient profiles, disease-resistant animals, these types of applications, which I really feel have such obvious benefit, it has to be addressed in terms of that overall risk-benefit perspective that unfortunately has been lacking in the GMO debate. I think everything has been about potential risks, and nothing's been about, but what about the potential benefits that we're foregoing by not allowing this technology? And that has to be brought into the discussion.
Sure. It seems to be a reoccurring theme here, is just analyzing the trade-offs and really evaluating, you know, what we're risking by doing nothing. It's very interesting. Right. So I know you have a petition going to try to get the FDA to right their ship, so to speak. Would it literally take an act of Congress to fix this?
Well, so there was an interpretation of the FDA, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act by the FDA to interpret intentional alterations in the genome as drugs. So that was an interpretation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act that was written back in, what did you say, 1937 or something. And that was not an act of Congress that made them do that. That was their interpretation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And so at the moment, that's a draft guidance. And what I find frustrating as an academic researcher is that there was a public comment period open to that in shortly after January of 2017 when it was introduced. And there hasn't been any response to the scientists that put in their comments about how this would really have a negative impact on our ability to utilize the technology if we regulate all of these animals as drugs, and what impact that would have on its potential use in animal breeding programs. And I don't feel there's been much of a two-way street. It was a fairly dictatorial, this is our draft guidance, and then there hasn't been a response to the public comments. And I don't know any researcher that thinks that this is a sensible approach to the regulation of genetically edited animals. I think everyone I speak to thinks that the regulations, and this is the National Academy of Sciences recommendation too, should be based on product risk and not on the breeding method that was used to introduce alterations. And so risk is associated with product, not with breeder intention, which is what the current trigger is. So if you intentionally made an alteration, you're regulated. But if God randomly made a mutation, that's not regulated. You know, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because in the case of risk, it's going to be associated with attributes of the product, and that's where the focus of regulations is. And so the petition is really asking for harmony between food, whether it's derived from plants or animals, in terms of the regulatory approach that's used, because currently plant breeders will be able to use this technology to introduce alterations that could have been achieved using natural breeding, but animal breeders will have to go through a multi-year, multi-generational new animal drug evaluation. And so it puts this weird difference between food derived from animals and food derived from plants. And so it really, I guess, there's not many of us that work in animal breeding, and so we're a very small community really that are affected by this, but the impact of improvements in animal genetics is really big in terms of the environment. There's been a lot of discussion recently around, you know, the impact of animal agriculture on the environment, and here's a technology, genetics, that's had this huge decrease in the environmental footprint of animal agriculture, and yet we're potentially tying the hands of breeders animal breeders behind their backs based on this regulatory approach that really isn't fit for purpose as it relates to this technology.
So are you hopeful as things go forward? I know things, I don't want to say bleak, but things are challenging right now. Are you thinking things are going to be reversed at some point, or are you just kind of just waiting to see what happens?
I guess 20 years ago, I might have been more positive. I kind of watched how this goes. I think what does encourage me is that governments in Brazil and Argentina and in the South American countries are taking a very proactive approach to saying, you know what, this is not going to be treated differently to conventional breeding. And so, and I mean, to the Nature article's premise, maybe the technology moves there, and maybe that's appropriate because that's where food insecurity and demand is. And actually, the largest cattle population on earth is in Brazil. So I guess I have hope that those younger countries that have food insecurity and a willingness to enable it, safe innovation in their breeding programs will allow this technology. And if that means that I can't use it, that makes me sad, and I think more concerningly, it worries me that it'll bootstrap kind of our young researchers in America and also certainly our agricultural industries in America from using the technology. But it does. I am optimistic that other countries are taking a more science-based approach to this, and so I'm hopeful the technology will be able to be used there.
Well, I guess we'll all cross our fingers and just see what happens. So if people want to learn more about your work and more about this issue, where would you send them? Obviously, they can go to our website at geneticliteracyproject.org, but specifically for the stuff that you're doing, where would you want to send people?
Well, I'm pretty transparent about what I do. If you want to go to the Animal Biotech website at UC Davis, I have all the projects we're working on and any publications that I've written. And I think that there are other groups that are trying to get information out there around this technology, but that's kind of like a Center for Food Integrity, I know, has some information on genome editing and trying to have a discussion around the potential benefits in addition to the risks, because I think we fell into that trap with GMOs where it was only a risk discussion. And I think that this approach can be used to solve real problems in agriculture. And given the kind of climate variability that we're experiencing, the ability to rapidly bring in useful genetic variation like drought tolerance or disease resistance is actually going to be really important for future breeding programs. And if we're going to forego this innovation, we better be pretty cognizant of what we're giving up and the potential opportunity costs associated with doing so. And I want that trade-off discussion to be really rigorous before any decision is made, because I do think that the benefits are very large in this particular situation.
All right. Well, Dr. Allison Van Eenennaam, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate the chat. Okay. And we'll just have to see what happens, huh?
Yep. Well, wait and see. May you live in interesting times.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for today. Thank you so much for listening. Just want to remind you, if you like the podcast, if these conversations seem interesting to you, check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. You can download the audio file from the website, and then you're also going to be able to download it from Spotify, iTunes, and Google Podcasts. So stick with us. We hope you'll be part of our audience. Thank you. Talk to you next time.